Hi, I'm Mike Stanton, publisher of Mergers and Acquisitions Magazine and Investment Dealer's Digest, and I'd like to welcome you to our first podcast on private equity investing in banks. At the highest level, this seems like a perfect marriage. U.S. banks need capital, and private equity firms need attractive investment opportunities. But deal flow in the sector remains slow. These transactions have proven to be more complex to execute for a host of issues, including regulatory uncertainty and cultural issues between private equity firms and bankings. To help us get a sense of the landscape today, I'm pleased to be joined by two partners from Goodwin Procter, Bill Stern from the Financial Services Practice in Washington, D.C., and Mike Kendall from the Private Equity Practice in Boston. Bill and Mike were both speakers at a symposium on private equity investments in banking that IDD and Goodwin Procter co-sponsored here in New York about 2 weeks ago, and we're very happy to have them with us today to share some of the insights from that session. Let me turn for the opening question to Bill. One of the reasons there's been so much interest in news about these transactions is there's a sense that the ground rules kept changing, that the FDIC was in a way moving the goalposts as the severity of the crisis became clear and the need for investment in banks was underscored. Where do we stand today, Bill? Is this regulatory environment favorable for getting these deals done?
Sure. Well, certainly the FDIC's issuance of its policy statement on investments in failed depository institutions was a positive development from the perspective that it certainly provided a little bit more certainty, even if investors didn't like all of the terms and requirements of the policy statement, but it certainly answered the question of where do we stand. So investors that are subject to the policy statement, which applies whenever a private investor is seeking to invest in a failed depository institution by acquiring the assets and assuming the deposit liabilities from the FDIC, you know, that group of investors knows what the requirements are, they know what the ground rules are. Now, that policy statement, of course, only applies to transactions involving failed depository institutions. It does not deal with, you know, the other transactions that might be out there in the marketplace, meaning investors that want to acquire healthy banks or at least banks that are not in receivership or make investments in those banks. And, you know, there's still, over the last year, there have been a lot of regulatory developments, which I think have answered a lot of the questions that have been out there. And so I think it's safe to say or fair to say that we're at a stage where the ground rules are, for the most part, pretty well understood, and that should provide the basis for transactions moving forward.
So what are the key ground rules? What do private equity investors have to know before they get into these transactions?
Well, at a very high level, I think the ground rules are, one, what do you need to do to avoid being regulated as a bank holding company or a savings and loan holding company? Because the restrictions on activities in the Homeowners Loan Act and the Bank Holding Company Act and the other requirements of those statutes, in particular the capital requirements and other requirements applicable to bank holding companies, are just non-starters for private equity firms. And so you need to structure your investment so that it's either a loan or as part of a club investment, a minority non-controlling investment. You know, if you're seeking to invest in a failed depository institution, obviously you need to keep in mind the requirements of the FDIC policy statement when it applies. So you would need to understand that the institution is going to have a minimum Tier 1 common equity ratio of 10% for the first 3 years of operation. That's a higher capital standard than what existing banks are subject to, and so investors would need to factor that in terms of figuring out what their returns are and figuring out what their bids would be. You need to take, you know, into account the fact that the FDIC requires a minimum holding period of 3 years, so there are going to be restrictions on transferability of the investment. The potential issues raised by the cross-support provision in that policy statement, making sure that if you are going to be making more than one investment, that you are attentive to who your other co-investors are and that you're not crossing that 80% threshold where you're as part of a group that also owns 80% of another institution that you've acquired from the FDIC, or else the cross-support provision would come into play. And then also just some of the things that came out of the conference that we had a couple of weeks ago in terms of, even if they're not legal or regulatory ground rules, just practical ground rules, which is to say that you need to have an experienced banker that knows what's going on and knows how to run a bank, and in particular in this challenging environment. Otherwise, the regulators really aren't going to look at your proposal seriously at all.
That's a great point. Mike, from the private equity side, when you're dealing with your clients, how are they approaching this issue of how to approach the regulators?
Well, I think the first and foremost rule is to let your management team do it for you. Bill alluded to the panel discussion we had a couple of weeks ago, and the folks on that panel were unanimous in saying that bank regulators are not particularly keen on hearing directly from private equity sponsors of these deals. Instead, they want to hear directly from the bank management teams. Those are the people who, with whom they're going to work and who are going to be charged with executing on the bank strategy, and those are the people who ought to be front and center in front of the regulators.
Now, how big a, you know, when you're talking about the private equity industry, you're talking about investors who are used to having a fairly involved hand in management. How big of a cultural change is it to approach these transactions where they have to take a minority role and they have to have management take the lead public eye?
I think it's a cultural change on both sides, frankly, because not many bank managers are used to having relatively active-minded investors in their capital structures. And the other interesting thing I think to note is that a lot of the early private equity institutions who saw opportunity in this space and began to make investments had a history of control-type investments. And so I think there there has been some tension with the cultural issues and also the regulatory issues and the investors having to change their mindsets and become used to the idea of being effectively minority investors. There are others, other private equity funds, for example, more from the lineage of what we refer to as growth equity, who are sort of more comfortable in the minority space. Those funds are probably finding it easier to negotiate these transactions because they're used to talking the talk of minority investments and they're comfortable with the input they have but also the input that they're not permitted to have.
Now, there are a few firms that have gone ahead and taken the jump and become full-fledged bank holding companies, right? Is that what went into those decisions? We talked to some of those at the event a few weeks ago.
Sure, and I think you're referring to the funds out there like CapGen and Belvedere, for example, where they have funds that have actually registered as bank holding companies. And for them, the decision really is a decision to focus essentially exclusively on investments in banks and financial services companies so that they're willing to live within the constraints of the Bank Holding Company Act in terms of limitations on activities. So that's really a strategic decision that they've made up front, that they're just going to focus on this industry to the exclusion of others. And obviously, as a consequence, they need to be prepared to meet all of the other requirements of the Bank Holding Company Act, meaning that the Fed is going to be in there supervising and examining them. They're going to be subject to, at least at each fund level, or at least for each separate partnership, would have to meet, you know, particular capital requirements to satisfy the Fed's risk-based capital requirements for bank holding companies. And they're not going to be able to make investments in non-financial companies, meaning that they're not going to have the sort of typical range of investments that you would see in a private equity fund. And that's fine for those particular funds, but for the vast majority of existing private equity funds that are out there, they're not going to be able to make that strategic decision because they've got an existing business and existing investments and existing investors.
And obviously, you guys are not investors themselves, but how much, you know, is all of this worth it? You know, or what are you hearing from the private equity side? Are they still seeing the opportunity to get a decent return here?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, just given the amount of activity in the space, the number of deals being talked about, the number of letters of intent being negotiated, all that sort of thing, I think it's absolutely clear that people still think that the industry is underpriced, sort of generally, as are probably most global assets at the moment, because the recovery is probably just beginning and nowhere near toward even its middle. So I think opportunities still are out there, and people see that. I think what is happening is the regulatory landscape, the uncertainty about what additional capital, if any, the government might put into the financial services sector and so on, have caused things to be just grinding along. So transactions, people expected, I think, greater velocity in the amount of deal-making in this space than we've actually seen. But I don't think the slowness is because there's a lack of interest. I think it's a combination of those things I said before, particularly the regulatory landscape. People are just getting hung up in discussions with, for example, the Fed, and trying to figure out what kind of a deal can we put together. The so-called silo transactions, of which there have been one or two, people think probably won't happen anymore, that the regulators probably aren't going to allow those. And so, generally speaking, the only way private equity funds really can get a deal done at the moment from a regulatory perspective is a so-called club deal, where a number of them come together, each of which takes a minority non-controlling investment. And the concept of putting together four or five or more private equity investors in a deal and herding all those cats successfully to actually get it closed is a challenge. And so I think we'll see, we'll continue to see deals, because I believe, and we were told over and over at the conference we held, that people in fact see lots of opportunity out there. I just think the pace of the deal making will be slow because of the nature of it.
That's definitely promising for the future. Can we take a step back and just since we do expect there will be more transactions and go down to the more granular level and ask, obviously we've spoken about control being a key factor here. Bill, could you address some of the issues, the very technical issues of how you avoid being deemed to have a controlling interest?
Sure. Well, for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act, the issue of control really is, and this is a bit of an oversimplified explanation, but it's really a matter of, in general, staying below 10% of a class of voting securities, or below 15% of a class of voting securities if you've gone to the Fed and you've entered into passivity commitments. Having said that, regardless of your level of ownership, even if you're below 10%, the Fed would still, I think, expect that you would behave as a passive investor. So the first step would be keeping your ownership of the voting securities below those thresholds, 10% if you generally want to avoid passivity commitments, 15% if you're willing to enter into passivity commitments with the Fed, but in either case, you're going to be held to the requirement that you act as a passive investor. Generally, you can't have more than one or perhaps two, in very limited circumstances, director interlocks, and certainly you wouldn't want your director to be the chairman of the board or the chair of a committee. Certainly you wouldn't want to have significant management interlocks at all, and you'd want to limit your business relationships with the company. In the context of a club deal, it's really important to make sure that you're not acting in a concerted manner with the other investors, that each investor is acting independently, and that you don't have governance arrangements set up where you could have a number of otherwise minority investors combining their votes in a way where they could sort of veto major actions by the company. Those types of veto rights, the regulators would, I think, could confer control on the investors. And, you know, certainly there's a limited ability to consult with management, but you need to be careful not to sort of cross the line into, you know, making threats either explicit or implicit about, you know, selling your shares or taking other actions in order to get management to do what you want. So those are just some of the steps that you would need to take in order to make sure that you don't have control. It's always very facts and circumstances specific, and very often, and in most cases, we would advise clients that they ought to go to the regulators, describe the investment, and at least get some informal comfort, if not more formal comfort, that they would agree and concur that there's not control.
It seems, given all those restrictions on your ability to act once the investment is made, a key decision is, before the investment is made, finding a management team that you trust and believe in. Can you guys discuss, are there any best practices for recruiting a bank management team to partner with as you pursue these transactions?
Well, I'm not sure what the secret sauce is, but I can tell you that the investors out there are meeting lots and lots of people. The panelists we spoke to the other day talked about numbers in the hundreds, certainly over 100, in terms of institutions they've talked to and management teams they've met, and probably of that number, 25 or 30 of them they probably know intimately well, and, you know, 10 or a dozen of them they're actively considering doing a transaction with. So there are a lot of people to talk to, a whole bunch of due diligence to do. And remember that because of the things we said before in regards to the fact that these are effectively minority investments and so on, there has to be a high degree of fit, comfort, trust, and so on between the private equity professionals and their management team. So I think, frankly, there's no substitute for a lot of hard work, a lot of time on planes, visiting a lot of people. And people are out there doing it.
Just more evidence that the sector is attractive from an investment perspective.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. Well, what other things do investors have to keep in mind? And are there any things that banks should keep in mind as bank management teams take a look at their fundraising options? Is this something they should be pursuing?
Sure. I guess a couple of thoughts there. One is that I think people have to have realistic expectations in terms of the business model that they can execute once they've got an investment in a bank. So early on, I think that there was a desire to acquire banks as a platform. Some people use the term expandable or inflatable charter, go out and do a bunch of acquisitions, sort of really blow it up into something bigger, and then ultimately exit the investment at a profit. And I think that the regulators are looking at this from the perspective of they're looking for safe and sound banking practices, that there may be a role for private equity in terms of providing additional capital to institutions that need it, but they're not looking for that capital to be deployed in a really aggressive growth strategy. They're looking for safe and sound, measured growth, focus on core deposits, and not on brokered deposits. And so it's really important to keep that in mind in terms of if you're looking to make an investment, that's the way that your capital is going to be deployed. It's not going to be you're not going to sort of blow up the bank into using one of these inflatable charter strategies. From the bank's perspective, I mean, certainly if you've got a bank out there that's looking for capital, I'm sure, and there are many banks out there looking for capital. For those banks, it may not be a question of whether it's a good idea or not. It's a question of survival in many cases. So if there's an investor that, or a group of investors that's coming along that's willing to provide the capital, the banks may have no other option. But certainly if these investments are all being structured as minority non-controlling investments, if the bank needs the capital, then this answers that need. And I suppose the bank would have to consider other factors like, the effect on it. It's going to be dilutive probably to its shareholders. So it would need to take into account those types of considerations. But very often it's just driven by they just need the capital to survive.
Okay. Well, thank you both for your time today. This is clearly an area that's going to be worth watching as we go forward as the deal volume picks up. So thanks again for your time, and we'll look forward to checking in probably in about a year.